supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A panel of federal court judges rules that Pennsylvania's congressional district map is constitutional. A group of Pennsylvania voters challenged the map, claiming it was an illegal partisan gerrymander favoring Republicans over Democrats and asking the court to order a new map before this year's midterms. In a 2-1 decision, the judges said the changes these voters are seeking should come from the political process rather than the courts. Now, it's not yet clear whether the plaintiffs will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The ruling comes as a similar case will be heard in the Pennsylvania High Court next week. Also today, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf declared the state's opioid addiction epidemic a public health emergency and ordered a command center set up to treat the crisis like it would a natural disaster. Joining us to make sense of the governor's 90-day disaster declaration is WHYY's Katie Meyer. Katie, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
This was broken up into some 13 initiatives. Help us make sense of them.
Sure. So these are all, I mean, I think the crux of it is this is going to speed up the way that the state can respond to opioid addiction and addiction crises by basically rolling back some regulations. So one of the big changes is there's going to be a new, what's called an opioid coordination group, and that's going to be within the State Emergency Management Agency, which, you know, usually handles, like, disaster relief and things like that. So that's going to be sort of the command center. That's where they're going to coordinate this effort from. Other changes are kind of across the board. They're going to let some of the high-performing drug treatment facilities that are doing well, bypass licensing requirements. They're going to speed up intake to treatment facilities by expanding who can admit patients. Right now only physicians can, but they're going to let nurses and others do that as well. One of the big ones is they're going to leave extra naloxone with overdose patients in case they need to be revived again. So when emergency workers respond, they can say, here's extra naloxone just in case. And naloxone helps revive overdose patients. So, it's a lot of different things.
And in addition, part of that acceleration is due to the fact that, like a public health emergency declaration, it gives state officials a lot of latitude regarding the existing rules and regulations.
It does, and that's sort of what each of these items is doing is kind of superseding an existing rule. So, for instance, on the naloxone thing, you weren't allowed to leave the drug with overdose victims before, but now, just for this 90-day period, you can. And what's interesting going forward on this is, as you said before, it's just 90 days, but what they're doing, or what they say they're planning on doing, is using this to decide whether or not these certain regulations really should be rolled back in the future. So I think they're already making plans to make some of these things permanent.
Pennsylvania sustained more than 4,600 fatal drug overdoses in 2016, and we are apparently joining, I believe, 8 states that already have this kind of declaration in place.
We're going to be the 8th state, yes.
Have they established enough of a track record that can we to determine what are realistic goals in, say, the first 90 days?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've been trying to reach out to other states that have done this. Most, have done this fairly recently, so there's not a whole lot of data we can go off of. I'm trying to, gather a little bit more information as we speak. But, for the states that have already done this, I think it's worth noting, like, Pennsylvania is in worse shape than a lot of them. The other states, just for the record, are Alaska, Arizona, Florida, Maryland, Massachusetts, Virginia, and South Carolina. So, we had, for instance, just in the last 2 years, from 2016 to 2017, we had the second highest jump in opioid-related deaths. So we're right up there in the worst cases.
Let's see. Democratic Attorney General Josh Shapiro calls Wolf's action an important step here in Philadelphia. Mayor Jim Kenney says the problem was particularly acute in the city and praises Wolf's declaration. Were there any naysayers today?
I wouldn't say there were any naysayers specifically. I think pretty much across the board, people agreed with the fact that we need to be paying more attention to this crisis. We need to be putting sort of, you know, taking an all-hands-on-deck approach to it. There was one group that appeared a little bit miffed. That was the House Republicans. I spoke to their spokesman, Steve Miskin, and he said, you know, basically he was unhappy that the governor had taken unilateral action on this. Or at least that he hadn't told House Republicans and other, you know, interested lawmakers farther beforehand. They learned about this last night. And so, you know, his argument was that, you know, they are an interested party in this, in addressing this issue. They've been introducing, you know, lots of bills, you know, across the aisle to address the opioid addiction crisis. And they would have liked to work together with the governor to sort of, you know, say where this thing should go. Because the governor did make a lot of just, you know, his own decisions on which regulations to waive. So I think the House Republicans would have liked at least some heads up on what he was doing.
The overall intent, obviously, is to save lives. And should it be determined rather quickly in coming weeks rather than 90 days, whether there's any effectiveness toward that end?
You know, I think it's going to be an ongoing thing. I will say, just, you know, from a data perspective, you're not going to get, like, a real clear picture of how this is helping just because there's so many fluctuations between weeks and even months. So 90 days even isn't a very long period of time to see how well this is working. But, you know, the administration says they hope that this is going to give them an idea of, you know, what direction they should be leaning in regulations-wise going forward.
Katie, thanks for joining us at the onset, and we'll be sure to be checking back with you as it plays out.
Thanks for having me.
WHYY's Katie Meyer on Newsworks Tonight. Meanwhile, as the number of opioid overdose deaths continues to rise, organ donation programs are also seeing an increase. Compared to a decade ago, overdose victims now represent a much larger share of those who make a life-saving gift after death. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Joel Wolfram reports.
Inside the Gift of Life donor program's headquarters in Philadelphia, there's a room that serves as mission control for organ donation. Three rows of desks face big screens that display records of potential organ and tissue donors. Workers here get a call every time someone dies in a hospital.
These guys are the hub of the wheel. They get the referral from the donor hospital. They separate the patients who are potential organ donors and notify our coordinator on call. We have 15 people on call per day in three states that go out to the hospital for organ donors.
That's Howard Nathan, Gift of Life's president and CEO. Gift of Life is the federally designated organ procurement organization in a territory that covers 11.2 million people in eastern Pennsylvania, South Jersey, and Delaware. Nathan says the 38,000 calls they get per year are increasingly deaths from drug overdoses.
10 years ago, only about 4% of our organ donors were from drug overdose. In 2017, it's 27% of our organ donors.
A total of 154 drug overdose victims within Gift of Life's territory became organ donors last year. Nationally, the number of these donors has more than doubled in the last 3 years to around 1,400. Organ donation is only possible when the cause of death destroys brain function but leaves the body's organs intact and on life support. That's often the case in drug overdose patients who are resuscitated after a long period of time without breathing. David Goldberg is a professor of medicine and a transplant doctor at the University of Pennsylvania.
A lot of the deaths are in young, otherwise healthy people whose bodies and organs can withstand that time when, you know, they're not breathing or their heart's not beating.
Drug overdose donors in Gift of Life's region were on average 32 years old when they died. That makes them good candidates for organ donation. And Goldberg says opioid drugs themselves don't do damage to organs. But donations from many drug users carry some increased risks.
There's this concern of an increased risk of transmission of hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and HIV. Those risks are still very small, but they're increased from baseline.
Federal guidelines put organs from people with a recent history of injecting drugs in a category of increased risk for disease. But improved techniques for detection have reduced the risk to the point that, for many patients, it's more likely they'd die waiting for the next organ. Gift of Life says about 20 people still die every day in the United States waiting for a transplant. but some patients are reluctant to receive organs with the increased risk label. Tom Burke of Folsom, Pennsylvania, needed a transplant in 2013 to cure his liver cancer.
And the first liver they offered me, I really didn't want it because the person was a drug addict and he did all kind of crazy other things, so I didn't want it.
Burke says the donor also had a history of high-risk sexual relationships. But within a month, his doctor brought him into the hospital to give him a liver from another donor.
He says, do you want to see your liver? Which at the time, I didn't know that Cody's liver was right next door to me.
The donor was Cody Souders. He was an 18-year-old from Easton, Pennsylvania, who had died in his home from an overdose of prescription painkillers. Cody's mom, Amy Souders, says he had elected to be an organ donor on his driver's license and that the family wanted to donate as much of Cody's body as possible.
So that his death wouldn't be in vain. And to be perfectly honest, the organ donation is really the only silver lining that we have in the whole situation.
Souders says her son made organ and tissue donations that went to over 50 people. Thousands of organ donors who were killed by opioid addiction have made donations like these possible. Gift of Life's Howard Nathan recognizes that the boon for organ donation comes out of tragedy.
Our job is to take the situation we have in front of us and try to turn it into an opportunity for new life for that donor and that donor family.
Tom Burke is now 70 and met the Souders family a couple years after surgery at the Gift of Life Donor Dash, an annual fundraising run in Philadelphia that supports organ donation.
Every one of them hugged me and wouldn't let me go. And they just was holding my side where, you know, my liver transplant where Cody was.
Souders says they've gotten together for a reunion at the Donor Dash every year since.
And all his children, his grandchildren, his wife. So they've all become, you know, part of our family.
For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
If you've ever driven, biked, or walked along Martin Luther King Drive in Philadelphia, you have Richard Sonny Driver to thank. The community activist, journalist, and Philadelphia booster was the driving force behind renaming that stretch of road along the Schuylkill River. Driver died recently at the age of 91, and WHYY's Annette John Haw offers this remembrance.
Throughout his long life, Richard Sonny Driver had his hands in a lot of things, starting out as a music promoter in the early 1960s. Back then, Driver brought some of the biggest jazz acts to Philly, as he told the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists when he was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award 4 years ago.
One main show that I gave every year was Down the Ridge and Over the Bridge every Easter Sunday. I booked them all, Gloria Lynn, Nina Simone. The biggest one was Ray Charles.
When the nightclub scene died down, Driver turned his attention to promoting the people and issues important to African Americans through Scoop USA, the community newspaper he founded and published for 57 years. In the early 2000s, Driver launched a petition drive to have Philadelphia's West River Drive renamed in Martin Luther King Jr.'s honor. Mayor John Street got on board, and the Fairmount Park Commission quickly approved the change. Linda Richardson, president of Uptown Entertainment, remembers the renaming ceremony.
I came to just be a participant. He said, oh, no, you're going to get in the official pictures. So that was one of the things about Sonny. He brought people in, whether you were famous or infamous or somebody on the street.
Driver distributed the Scoop USA newspaper himself until well past his 90th birthday. When he received his Lifetime Achievement Award in 2014, Driver let people know while he appreciated the honor, he still had work to do.
I said, now I'm not finished yet. I don't have to wait till I'm finished and then give it to me.
Services for Sonny Driver will be held on Friday. Annette John Haw, WHYY News.
6 years ago this month, violence rocked Alexander McClure Elementary School in North Philadelphia. After school hours, a man was shot and killed on the school's playground. But the community has worked hard to reclaim that space and turn it into a place of healing. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports.
For years, McClure's exterior was a dismal collage of maroon paint and brown brick, says Principal Sharon Marino.
And so the schoolyard was very, I'm going to use the word drab.
Layered on top of that gloom was the painful memory of a slaying that was far too close for comfort. When Marino started in 2013, people didn't talk openly about the incident.
But it was always in the back of our minds that we can always do better. We can always do better to improve our school, to improve our community, to make the school a safe haven and a place where kids and families will want to come.
To do that, McClure students started transforming their once tainted playground. With the help of a community art group called Cosa Cosa, they created murals that now adorn most of the school's exterior. For the last 5 years, they've made tile mosaics of butterflies and neighborhood scenes and flowers, painted in brilliant yellows and reds. Community members started to notice.
I mean, the neighbors across the street have said to me, I love what you're doing. They said, I want to know what you're going to do next.
Over the 5 years of the project, students have also recorded their thoughts about art. Many, like Zion Jefferson, say it helped them deal with strong emotions.
If I'm feeling moody, I will draw something that shows how I feel. The best thing about art is it doesn't have to be perfect, to be beautiful.
And in this imperfect place, beauty now abounds. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
In 2015, a young Philadelphia native named Phoenix Best went straight from the theater program at DeSales University to Broadway, where she became an understudy in the revival of the musical The Color Purple. Then she filled in for a vacationing actress in Broadway's Dear Evan Hansen. And now, for the first time, she's playing in Philadelphia as the character Eponine in the Broadway tour of the classic musical Les Miserables. For WHYY, Howard Shapiro talked with Phoenix Best earlier today.
Phoenix Best, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
You had a pretty fast track to Broadway.
I did.
Talk to me about DeSales University, which is up in
Center Valley.
Center Valley, just north of Quakertown.
Mm-hmm.
You were a theater major in music theater?
Yes, I was.
Were you one of the students who worked with the Shakespeare Festival?
I did. I worked for the Shakespeare Festival for 3 years as an intern.
We should say that the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival is housed at DeSales, University,
yeah,
which has quite a vibrant theater department.
It does.
And what did you learn there that later on you were able to use right away because you got a job right away?
Yeah, I feel like I learned a lot about perseverance and, like, you know, that this industry is very challenging and that you have to work really hard in order to get the things that you want. And DeSales University had some really great shows, but there were some shows I just, like, couldn't be a part of. Some of the shows weren't as diverse, and they're starting to have more and more and more diversity as the years go on. But while I was there, there wasn't much diversity. And so I had to kind of challenge myself. And so I went to the dance department, started dancing, and then started doing that in some of the musicals. And so I feel like I learned a lot about myself as a performer, also from the classes. But even doing Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival, just watching professional actors work was so much. It was like just as great as the classroom. It was a classroom being backstage with them.
When you left DeSales, mm-hmm, you decided to go right to New York.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a little risky?
It was, but while I was still doing the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival the summer after my senior year, so I was at the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival until August of 2015, but while I was there, like a few weeks before it was over, there was an open call for Wicked on Broadway to understudy Elphaba, and I randomly went to it, and long story short, throughout a week and a half, I got called back 4 times, and I got down to the final two. And then I found out my last week at PSF that I didn't get it, and that was okay, but they were like, you need to move to New York. And so I finished PSF, and then 10 days after PSF was over, I was like, Mom, I need to move to New York. So I moved to New York and stayed in my friend's spare room. They let me stay with them. I stayed there with them for about a week and a half before I ended up getting my own apartment, finding a job. And in that interim, like the day I moved there, I ended up getting an email from the same casting agency as Wicked. And they were like, hey, we want you to come in for The Color Purple on Broadway as a swing. And I was like, okay, sure.
Can you explain to people what a swing is?
Yeah, a swing is someone who is in the building at all times for the show, and they know every ensemble track. Sometimes there are swings who also know principal tracks as well, but generally it's like all of the ensemble tracks. So I understudied 5 of the women in the ensemble.
Wow.
Yeah.
And after The Color Purple, you landed also an understudy role in Dear Evan Hansen. Mm-hmm. You don't pick small musicals.
No.
So this is your first principal position in a major Broadway musical.
Yes.
And you're back home.
Mm-hmm.
Is your family going to see it?
Yeah, my family has tickets throughout the next 2 weeks. Like, someone will definitely be there every night.
You gave your first performance at the Academy last night, I think, Tuesday night.
Yeah.
What did it feel like? Anything different?
The whole show felt different for me. I mean, I was nervous. I was excited. I was scared. There were so many emotions. I almost cried once, and I'm not a crier. But it was really cool to step foot on that stage and just look out. I remember in our sound check before the show, I stepped on the stage, and I was like, wow. Because I know what it looks like from the other way, from being in the audience. I don't know what it looks like from being there. And it's like everyone keeps being like, oh, my gosh, your home theater is so beautiful. And I was like, yeah. It is.
Phoenix Best, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you.
Phoenix Best spoke with Howard Shapiro. The national tour of Les Miserables is at the Academy of Music. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. As the nation's rate of overdose death continue to climb, Congress has convened a task force on heroin use and trafficking. A surprising number of lawmakers from our region serve on that force, and on tomorrow's show, they'll weigh in with their priorities for 2018. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.